Hi, I'm Renee.
And I'm Anthony. We are the voices and founders of Blue Soul Earth, where we teach and we lead workshops and retreats about heart-centered living and unity consciousness.
Welcome to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. We combine esoteric wisdom and the experiences that people have had for millennia and beyond with the latest breakthroughs in science, health, cosmology, physics, and the arts.
In each episode, you'll tune into cutting-edge visionaries who are making a powerful dent in consciousness from different industries and cultures around the world.
Our interviews cross boundaries and at times break conventional thinking as we redefine what reality is, what spirituality means, and what consciousness does.
Your journey to connecting to your higher self, expanding your awareness, and deepening your consciousness starts here.
We're sitting here talking with Chamonix Jain and about some of her work with healing, self-healing, her clinical trials, the work that she does in converging both science and spirituality together. Dr. Chamonix Jain is a psychologist, a scientist, and a social entrepreneur. She serves as adjunct faculty at UC San Diego, where she's an active member of the UC San Diego Center for Integrative Medicine's Research Committee. She is also the founder and CEO of the Consciousness and Healing Initiative, a nonprofit collaborative accelerator that connects scientists, health practitioners, educators, and artists to help lead humanity to heal ourselves. Her best-selling book, Healing Ourselves, Biofield Science and the Future of Health, is full of great data that supports how we are wired to heal ourselves and beyond. And so one of the first things that I was curious about when I met you years ago at, I think it was Wisdom 2.0, what brought you from your original studies in science to then kind of, you know, what was the very first thing that kind of opened up the pathway from science to spirituality?
Well, I'll be honest, I really started with spirituality growing up in an East Indian Jain household here in the Deep South. So all my friends were Baptist Christians and I wasn't, right? But I would go to church with them. I'd kind of learn about Christianity, being, you know, surrounded by Baptist Christians at that time. And they were curious about our traditions as Jains. And so they would come to our house and ask questions like, why don't you eat meat? And what are the basic, you know, concepts of Jainism? So I always grew up surrounded by spirituality, both my own and my family and my friends. And so as I continued to go to school and found that my interests were really in healing, it never made sense to me that we didn't talk about spirituality. In fact, we didn't even talk about how the brain and the body were connected when I was going to school. Everything was really in the 90s when I went to Columbia University for my undergraduate work. We had just started really getting into neuroscience. So this was in the early 90s. And while we were really getting into the brain study, we also were being told things like the brain doesn't change after age 7. So that didn't make sense. And then I wondered whether we were missing the boat because there were certain things that we just weren't talking about. At that time, people didn't even use the word consciousness very much. You know, it was all about what parts of the brain light up when I do this or that. And there was no brain-body connection. So I started seeking out disciplines that I thought, first of all, were more systems-oriented, and second, kind of looked at the full picture of a human being, not just the brain, although I love the brain. Well, we all love our brains, you know, that's great, but there's something beyond that. So I found this discipline of psychoneuroimmunology, which stated that it was interested in looking at the mind and the emotions and its effects on the body. So I thought, oh, okay, this is whole system. I don't know if they're interested in all of the spiritual questions I have, but psyche means spirit after all. So it seemed like a good area for me to go into. And I'll be honest, when I started my PhD work, I called my mentor to be at that time, and I knew what I wanted to do. So I called him and I said, I have acceptance into this great program in clinical psychology, UCSD, SDSU, joint doctoral program in clinical psychology, strong research emphasis. And I know I want to do a research study on energy healing. Would you support that? And, you know, he took a pause and then, you know, his famous words, yeah, I think we can do that. You know, so I was really lucky because I did have to seek out mentorship and really ask for what I wanted. But I got great training, you know, in a solid discipline at one of the best universities for my program, clinical psychology, psychoneuroimmunology training. And then I used all that training to study what we would call the spiritual dimensions of health and healing. So I feel very privileged that I had those opportunities.
Yeah, I think that many, you know, universities, especially traditional universities, would have turned a blind eye to that, right? To say that that's, you know, I mean, I've often heard this, right? Where people from the world of science and medicine try to legitimize energy healing and they get shut down or told at worst, you know, this will be the end to your career before you've even begun.
Oh, and I was told that. I mean, look, there was a bit of playing the game just to get into those schools. The first time I applied to graduate school, I was very honest about what I wanted to do, and I didn't get in anywhere. The second time, I actually did what they told me to do, which is to say that my interests were really very aligned with the mentors. It's the whole game. There's a whole academic game that goes on, right? I'm sure you're aware. So that helped me actually get to the interview stage and move forward. And then as I talked with my mentors, though, it was important for me to say, look, I know what I said, and I am interested in the basic work that you do. And I kind of have some other interests, too. And I'm just letting you know that, you know, these are areas that I'm really passionate about that I hope at some point in my career I can pursue. And then, of course, when I got admitted, I said, this is what I want to do. And I remember when I went for my postdoc at UCLA, and I won't name names, but a very well-known researcher, in fact, long story, but I was supposed to actually work with him at UCSD, and then he moved to UCLA to start a giant program there. I ended up having him as my postdoc mentor. And I remember presenting my data at Psychoneuroimmunology Society. So this was the randomized controlled trial that I had conducted, actually as a graduate student with funding from the NIH and extramurally, to look at hands-on healing. That's what I had set out to do. And I had received a small award, like a student award, from Psychoneuroimmunology Research Society, and I was presenting on the work. And he took me aside privately, and he said, you have to stop this. People are not ready for this kind of work. You're going to ruin your career.
Yeah.
And I really sat with that. And I said, well,
this was late 90s.
This was now, you know, early 2000s, right? So at this point, I had finished my PhD work going into postdoc at UCLA. I had done my clinical research in energy healing. But now it's like, okay, now you're entering the serious trenches of academia. You're no longer a student. You're going to be looking for junior faculty positions and so forth and so on. You got to stop this. Nobody gets it. They just
but
don't.
Is that what you wanted to do? Did you want to teach, or were you looking at?
Well, I wanted to pursue the study of healing, and I didn't understand why I wasn't going to be able to do that in the confines of academia. It made no sense. We're higher institutions of learning. We're here to learn, right? And ultimately, as a clinician, I'm here to figure out what's best for patients. So I really didn't understand what he was saying because I wasn't there to serve my career. I was there to explore, as a scientist does, what's possible and what's beneficial for our patients. So I kind of ignored him, to be honest. And, you know, long story short, I did my postdoc at UCLA, got hired by the nonprofit that had helped support my research as a graduate student. And I was a senior scientist with that nonprofit for 4 years. Ultimately then began my own nonprofit to forward this space in a big way, because the bottom line, Renee, is this: since my study, there have been so many studies demonstrating the positive impact of what we call energy healing. We scientists like to call them biofield therapies, right? We can talk about what do we mean by the biofield. There's so much now good, credible research done by tenured professors at major universities that are pointing to something extraordinary. And yet, because of the machine kind of way that we run our systems, you know, all over the world, but in the US and academia is, you know, it's sort of a slow moving, slow changing system. I realized we needed a more nimble type of organization to support these scientists and really move this field forward. So I started my own nonprofit called the Consciousness and Healing Initiative. And our goal is to lead humanity to heal ourselves. We bring in diverse perspectives from researchers, healing practitioners, spiritual leaders, educators, and artists so that we can understand from a whole systems point of view how healing works and place that into healthcare and into self-care. So that's really the work that our nonprofit does, and that's really what I've dedicated myself to.
When you speak of whole system, I'm sure that, you know, the the people who have been studying this for years know that, but can you explain to people where that might be a new phraseology?
Absolutely. And, you know, to your initial point, this is why it's so important, and we take very seriously at our Consciousness and Healing Initiative that we bring scientists and healers together, because scientists don't have all the answers. And I can tell you some of the stories of our randomized controlled trial and all the things I learned about, can you conduct a randomized placebo controlled trial in energy healing? Is it really telling you what you think it is? That's the kind of study I ran. It's published in the journal Cancer. And I learned what the practitioners were telling me about what do you really mean by a mock healer or placebo. So our knowledge of healing is really going to be informed by both perspectives, and what we need to do is really come together so we can share our skill sets, because the practitioners have wisdom that will and does guide the research. The researchers are trained, you know, so they have some good ideas about how to set things up, but ultimately the practitioners got to be deeply involved in the protocol development, and that's what we do at the initiative. It's a collaboration. So in terms of whole systems, another way to think about it is whole person. And that's kind of a simpler way to talk about it, in, you know, as far as health and healing goes. Whole systems is something we talk about when we talk about even systems biology, you know, kind of looking at the holistic picture. So what is that? Like, for example, if we look at proteomics, right, we're not just looking at one or two proteins. We're trying to look at the entire gamut of the proteins and infer certain patterns. That's whole systems. And a lot of people have adopted that to talk about, what do we know about things like Ayurveda and Chinese medicine, Tibetan medicine? Those are sometimes called in our field whole systems medicine or whole person medicine. Why? Because we understood that our health isn't just about the chemicals that move in our body or even just our physical body. It's about our spiritual connection, our relationships, huge driver of health and healing, our emotional states, our social milieu, like, you know, including whether we come from economically advantaged or disadvantaged communities, right? Our physical health and what we eat, you know, and
all of that affects, yeah. I mean, we're energy beings, right? A lot of times people, you know, they don't understand that this is more of a perception than reality, and that we are energy beings having this physical experience. And so all of that impacts it, right? The chi.
Yes, all of it. You know, that's still hard for most people to grok, you know, people who don't do energy healing or yoga or whatever. If you say, hey, you're really energy and you're just in this physical body, it kind of freaks some people out. You know,
it does.
So the way that I like to share it with patients who are just learning about this field, for example, is your physical body, we're learning from science, is completely backed up, as you know, from rock solid science at this point, that your physical body is an emanation of your whole person health. And that means that what you eat matters, what you think matters, how you feel matters, your relationships matter, and you're experiencing this on a moment-to-moment level. So I'm beginning to help people understand that when we talk about energy, we can also talk about it as subtle awareness. That gives somebody an anchor, okay? So we start with the body. How does this feel in my body? And then we can get more nuanced. Well, do I feel it in my tissues, or do I feel energy around the body, or what is it that I feel? So we're bringing people back to the experience of themselves as energetic beings, because this is not theoretical, right? The more that we're tuned into our experience as energetic beings, the more it makes sense. But our systems haven't been set up that way, right? We haven't been taught to think of ourselves as energetic beings unless we came from a deeply spiritual background or sought that out for ourselves. Certainly at school, they didn't teach us about us being energetic beings, right?
Well, have you explored, you know, I know this is a different side of science, but, you know, the quantum physics piece of it, right? The observer effect, right? And the observer changes, even though they can't necessarily pinpoint or prove how it works, you know, the spooky action at a distance that Einstein's so renowned for saying, right? That hasn't been around for that long, 100 years, and it's still widely debated, right? When I think about that, it's like, well, we can't prove it, but we know that observing something shifts, you could say, the consciousness of the energy that's existing. So maybe you can explain that from your perspective.
Absolutely. And there are organizations that have actually tried to apply that to science and say, if there is this observer effect that we're seeing, what does that mean for science? Can we ever be unbiased? And, you know, can we ever do replication studies in the right way? So certainly the findings of quantum physics are informing the development of many of our scientific disciplines, including biology. And I actually do talk about this in my book, Healing Ourselves, which, the first part of that book is sort of the philosophies of consciousness and energy, consciousness, the biofield, and healing from indigenous perspectives and modern philosophical perspectives. The second part of the book is all about, where's the evidence? Are there evidence behind mind-body spirit practices? What about placebo? How do we understand that? And what about energy healing? And then the third part is all practical. But there's a section in my book where I dive into quantum physics and what we really know about it as a possible explanation, for example, and healing. And here's what we do know already, just from the short amount of time that we've been really looking at this. We do know now that entanglement happens in macro systems. It's not just for atoms anymore. There are actually experiments published in the best journals like Nature and
I
Science.
didn't realize that because even some of the more recent quantum books that I've read, they still talk about entanglement only with microsystems.
No, we're now seeing it not only in macro systems, like, in atoms, beyond atoms, but actually in crystals. My book is heavily referenced. I mean, there must be over 700 peer-reviewed published references in that book because I want to make sure what I'm saying people can really sink their teeth into and know that it's a real thing. It's not just hand waving. So we've seen that.
So just for people who are just kind of tuning in, this is your new book, Healing Ourselves, Bioscience and the Future of Health, right? That
Correct.
came out in September. So, okay. So like, yeah.
It's already in its second printing. I'm
Yeah.
so excited about
I
that.
know, I saw that. That's exciting.
It's great. So anyway, we know that quantum entanglement actually happens in macro level systems, and we're finding effects for what we call quantum-like behavior in biology. So many of my scientific colleagues are saying, we're starting to pave an era for what we call quantum biology, which is that the lens of how we're now looking at living systems, including things like photosynthesis and even animal migration and different aspects of biology and function, we now seem to be able to better explain looking at them as quantum effects instead of looking at them from the Newtonian Cartesian view. What does that mean ultimately? It means that we're learning more about the way things work in our world and our relationship to it and what's possible. And it may help us understand things that have seemed totally mysterious, like channeling, like distant healing, right? Like these things that seem so out of bounds and like, well, science doesn't have any explanation for that. Well, we're still learning in science. Science is continuously evolving. And so if we start tracking the evolutions of things like quantum physics, we're a long way from explaining distant healing by quantum physics, really. And I state that really clearly in my book. But if you start connecting all the dots, you understand why it's plausible.
What
Why it
about channeling? You mentioned channeling. What do you see as potentially the biggest gift that is emerging from some of this new research that can support channeling?
As you may know probably better than I, being in this field more deeply, people like our colleagues at the Institutes of Noetic Sciences have been looking at things like potential brainwave changes during channeling. There's been some of that going on over the last decade. So we're still trying to use these reductionist approaches to kind of look at the physiology because we live in such a materialist, reductionist world in terms of the way science is done that people keep going to that. But when you look at the experiences that people are having, the information that a person who is channeling is getting is too specific, and the data does corroborate this, right? The data backs up what the channelers are saying. They're getting very specific information. How is that happening, right? That could be due to what we call a quantum collapse that allows us to receive information that is in the non-physical realm. It's very hard for us as Western scientists to grok this, but yet this wisdom has been around for millennia in almost every culture because their cosmology was one that was completely different from a reductionist cosmology, which has driven the way things have been going on in the West since at least the Industrial Revolution, right?
Yes.
So.
I mean, we have so much to learn from our indigenous elders, right? And it's something that I think, they had a more tangible relationship with their intuition in a way that we've just forgotten because we're out of practice, right? It's a muscle that needs to be used. And, we certainly find that the more that you practice, right, with an art, the stronger it's going to get. And the same is true with energy healing.
It really is. And it's a good time for us to take stock in the reality of these abilities that we have, whether we consider them latent or just underdeveloped, because there are forces at play that are going to be shifting and shaping the way that we work with our consciousness. And so we really have to be in this state of conscious choice making all the time because, am I going to go jump into the metaverse and, kind of try to feel people through my sensors and these things like that? Or am I actually going to learn how to tune into someone as healers do and feel them and send healing to them without having to use all these contraptions? Am I going to utilize my visualization and my intuitive skills for my spiritual benefit? Or will all of these abilities be co-opted for an entertainment factor? Right, so.
So that lends us into a few areas we haven't talked about yet. Let's call it ways to get there, right? Ways to access the subtler dimensions, ways to access higher consciousness, if you want to call it. And there's so many different ways to do that, right? There's psychedelics, there's, frog medicine, there's meditation, right? One of our favorites. So maybe you can speak to a few of these.
You bet. I mean, what's so beautiful too from the data's perspective is that, these sayings of many paths lead to the same destination is really true. It's just a question of which one is most sustainable for you and which one makes sense for you and what you can really commit to. I am kind of old school in this way that I feel like committed practice is really essential. Let's say you're, a person who really loves to take entheogens and you get a lot of benefit from taking entheogens, right? There's more and more data coming out from that yet. Whether we have a profound spiritual experience from an entheogen or just through meditation, either way, the integration process is key. Right now we're all, as a society, finally opening up the conversations around trauma, which is great. What comes after trauma? It's integration. So it's not if, so whether it's spiritual experience or trauma, the field is expanded, right? There is a new knowledge and there's an integration process that needs to happen, either because you've released something massively from your field that didn't serve you anymore, so you've got, this opportunity to build your field, right? Or you had this massive, extraordinary experience and now you got to go home and do the dishes, right? So how do you do that?
How
So
do you stay grounded? I mean, I think that's part of what we've seen with some of the substances, right? That it can be really, really effective for trauma, but then you get hooked by that multidimensional experience that is so outerworldly that you don't want to come back to the here and now. And I think that's a challenge. How do you get grounded again?
Absolutely, and not engage in spiritual bypassing or spiritual escapism. We're
I
here
love
in
that.
these physical bodies. We live in the world. It's the mundane, the sacred, the profane, all at once, right? So how do we really manage that and lead whole lives? And this is where I think choosing a dedicated practice, whether you engage in entheogens or not, is really key. To all of our success, both individually and as a society. And it might shift. Maybe you try yoga for a while and then you say, I'm ready to try Qigong. I want to try this practice of meditation. Some people want to pick one thing and they stick with it for 30, 40, 50 years. Other people like to shift depending on what's going on in their lives and where they think they need help. What's great is the data is pretty clear that all of these things have some common effects. First of all, they all help to harmonize our nervous system. So the data is very clear on that nearly all of these spirit mind body practices would have been called mind body practices here in the West, like Tai Chi, like Qigong, like mindfulness meditation, mantra meditation, and other forms of concentrated meditation, yoga. They all show beneficial effects in things like reducing anxiety, reducing pain. There are studies with all of these practices looking at the effects on our parasympathetic or rest and digest nervous system. We tend to live in a push-pull world that activates our sympathetic or get up and go system a lot, right? So most of us can use a little bit more parasympathetic activity. It's a balance between those two aspects of our nervous system. All of these practices help to harmonize the nervous system, maybe in different ways. For some, it's breathing that's helping drive the effects. For others, it may be movement. And the part that really hasn't been examined so deeply, I think, in terms of its effects, is the spiritual dimension, the spiritual connection, right? Because we're looking at these effects on physiology, but what is the real driver for our well-being? And what do all these practices have in common? They're to unite us back with our spiritual essence, our spiritual core. It isn't actually to breathe better or even to have less anxiety. It's to unite us with our spiritual core. And when we're united with our spiritual core, then we see all of these benefits because we don't need to be anxious. We're not in the conditioned mind anymore. You know, it's the conditioned mind that causes anxiety, not the spirit.
You have a lot of the evidence, but you know, for us, it's just experiential, right? That if you're connecting to your higher self, then you're on your so-called soul's journey, right? Which may be too esoteric of a language for the mainstream, but really that soul's journey is where, you know, what we like to say, you're plugging into the love grid opposed to the fear grid, right? And I think you don't have anxiety when you're not plugging into the fear grid. So, you know, that's what really creates a lot of angst for us now, which actually, you know, brings me to the topic of something we haven't talked about. And I don't even know, because I didn't really see it in any of the stuff about you, but I am sure it's come up. And that's technology, the impact of, you know, EMFs and advanced technology and how much of that is impacting that sort of fight or flight and anxious states.
Much discussion on this with our scientific community and our practitioner community, and opinions, you know, are a little diverse here. There are a few scientists that feel like, you know, the EMFs aren't really the driver of all the chronic disease and things like that we're seeing. There are other scientists that feel like 5G, you know, is a huge problem and is, you know, affecting people's immunity. There's research all over the place on all of these different aspects. I'll tell you what my healing teacher, Reverend Rosalind Bruyere, says about it, which is that we are going to continue to sort of live in a world where there is all of this EMF, right? And EMF pollution, and the biggest aura wins. So what does that mean for us?
The biggest aura?
The biggest aura wins. What does that mean for us? It means that the more grounded we are and the more we're taking care of our personal field, the less likely we are going to be susceptible to EMF effects. So, you know, there are some people that are sensitive that just need to have an EMF-free environment. You know, that's just the way that they're wired. And then there are other people, because maybe of their constitution and because of the way that they're grounded and because of their practice, they can tolerate those kinds of, you know, effects, frequency effects. I mean, you can even liken this to toxins in food and whatever, right? We have toxins in food as well. Nobody wants toxins in our food, for sure. But we have these conscious choices about, you know, how we eat our food. And if there is toxicity, that we don't have to live in, like you said, the fear factor. We can be in the love factor. We can be grounded. We can say, I'm going to digest what I need and I'm going to release the rest. And
right. I was just going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you, how much does it play into intention, that our intention is what matters the most and all of this, right? It's not, you know, so much like blessing the food, but being one with the food, being having gratitude for the food, realizing, understanding, intending, encompassing, right? Every aspect of what we digest and put into our body. More in the spiritual esoteric circles, they really just speak to it that way, but we don't have the science or the data to prove that yet, really.
Kind of, though. We have a little bit of, not just a little bit, we have a tremendous amount of data from, for example, of what we've called the placebo literature, right? So if we start looking at that, and you know, there's so much to explore in what you just said, because again, our ancient traditions and our energy healing teachers will tell us where the mind goes, energy follows. So if my mind is, you know, anxious and thinking that I'm going to get sick from EMFs, I'm going to cause more probability for that to happen because I'm already thinking that way, right? And I'm aligning my energy in that way because I'm plugged into the fear grid, as you said. Right. So there's that. And that's part of what we call nocebo in science. Right. So the nocebo effect is just the placebo effect backwards, which means if I have a negative expectation of something, I'm going to be more likely to experience that negative effect than if I didn't think that. The nocebo effect is powerful. We've traced it down to, you know, the way that it affects the brain. It starts to light up some of the same pathways, not surprisingly, that we might see in anxiety and negative, what we call negative affect, negative emotion. And that predisposes us to have more of a a sympathetic nervous system arousal, which means that we don't repair our bodies as well because the parasympathetic nervous system maybe isn't online as much. So this is all traceable to physiology, right? On the flip side, and I go through this, Renee, I'm like fascinated with the placebo effect. And so I talk a lot about it in my book. I have a whole chapter that I call Placebo Equals Heal. Because here's what we know, placebo effects, or, you know, it's even beyond the power of positive thinking, and we can break down all the aspects of, quote, placebo. We see them in surgery, meaning people can get placebo surgery and get better. Surgery, most people don't know that. We see it in drugs like antidepressants and even treatments for Parkinson's and other things, okay? We see it in holistic approaches, including things like acupuncture and energy healing. Right. We see so-called placebo effects all over the map. In fact, now our latest studies from our colleagues at Harvard University are showing that you don't even have to be tricked. I can give you a placebo and tell you it's a placebo and you will get better. So placebo is completely backwards.
I think I heard Bruce say that once too, actually, come to think of it. So how does that play into the miraculous or the so-called miraculous cures from stage four cancer?
You can create healing for yourself by maximizing these so-called placebo variables. And I give a step-by-step instruction on how to do that in my book. But essentially, I reframe this as heal. Placebo equals heal. Holistic elements that activate life force because they are present in every clinical encounter. So some of the factors, just briefly, that influence our ability to heal or these so-called placebo effects, which include expectation, how much I think a treatment is going to help me, conditioning, which means how much my body mind actually experienced a benefit before. If I got energy healing and it went well for me, the chances are the next time I get it, my mind body is going to be in a receptive state to receive it again. So expectation, conditioning, ritual, okay? We have rituals in every healing encounter, including in modern medicine. We can make these rituals work for us. I have a whole suggestion of how people can come, create a sacred space, create a sacred place, come into their bodies, ground, sound an invocation, get clear on their intentions, ask for support, and surrender. That's all part of making a healing ritual work for you, and it's very powerful. Right. So there are those ways. And then there's relationship, which includes the relationship with your providers, how much you trust them, how much they believe in you. All of these things affect powerful healing. And what we found is that often in these states of so-called remission for cancer, even the energy healers who might be working, for example, with people like that, will tell families or caregivers to set up these situations for positive healing. They're all what we call contextual or cognitive or emotional factors that affect healing, right? Ultimately, what again they're doing is helping clear the way for the spirit to take charge. And, you know, I personally believe that that's why we see these effects. We're literally clearing the karmic debris, if you will, right? In order for the soul's light to fully shine through and guide the healing path more directly. Now, that's my personal opinion. Do we have data showing that, you know, in the way that I just described? No, we don't. But we certainly have a lot of people's written and told experiences that say that's how they experienced it.
So it sounds like almost what you're saying is a Reiki master, right? And one of the in a couple of different systems, and they all talk about you being the vessel, emptying out and being the vessel. So it sounds like you're kind of speaking to that, where we let go, we surrender, which is really the advice of some of the most ancient sages and mages that have ever existed, right? Emptying yourself, surrendering into, and then allowing spirit to take over and do the work.
Absolutely. That's the commonality that we see across all healing traditions. I am not doing the healing. I am getting myself grounded, present, surrendering my ego, and allowing for spirit or energy, higher guidance, God, however they describe it, to help facilitate the healing. Now, for energy healers, you know, there's a certain amount of training and skill that some of them have. So it's not like they're completely passive, but what they'll often say is spirit comes in and tells me what to do. You know, So I may think that I'm supposed to do this, but I might get guided from spirit to do something that I didn't think of before, right? So there's a sense of, yes, you're a facilitator, but you're not really the healer. You know, consciousness is the healer. And in fact, you're just stimulating that connection with consciousness for your client or the patient or the person you're helping. they're really doing their own healing. You're just creating the conditions for success.
That's right. That's right. That is so spot on. If only people could understand that. I think you had mentioned spiritual bypassing, which comes up a lot in our work too. And I'm kind of curious about that, because when we go to a healer and we're like, okay, heal me, that's a form of spiritual bypassing in a way.
Yeah. This is the biggest thing for all of us, is we all have to take, I wouldn't even say responsibility. We have to know that we are our own creative healing agents.
We're active participants.
The biggest thing that we have to learn on this planet is how powerful we are, how much our spirits lead the way to create the world that we want to see. It's really that simple. And we're at this tipping point, as Bruce likes to say, you know, we're at the tip of a sixth mass extinction. And, you know, I have a whole spoken word piece I did on that when I heard him say that when we were co-teaching recently. And I said, yeah, that's really heavy. You know, it's like really heavy to think about. We don't have to live that way.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's almost, and this is kind of a good segue because I know we have to wrap shortly here, but just that, you know, how can we support each other? Because I think part of that big, massive heaviness of understanding, you know, it's like cognitive dissonance, like, no, it can't be that way. That's the way that I've been trained and conditioned so differently than this, right? It causes cognitive dissonance. And, you know, there's all these wires that say it cannot possibly A, be that easy, or B, we can't possibly have been lied to by science for this long. And I think there's another conversation. It doesn't have to be so black and white. I mean, you know, I think that spirituality and science need to come together and not look at each other as these polar opposite forces fighting each other, right?
And absolutely. They're just two languages to understanding truth. You know, there's no opposition. There never has been any opposition. And we need to come into our full resonance, as we talked about earlier, whole human beings, spiritual and physical. Each is a reflection of the other.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's what really drew me to your work. And I think so many other people, I love what you're doing with your organization. And I haven't read the book yet, but apparently it's on its way.
Well, that's great. I look forward to hearing what you think of it. Yeah. I've got really good feedback. And, you know, in closing, I just want to say, for anyone who is listening to this and thinking about it, thank you for your work and your interest, because a lot of the work that our organization is doing now is to empower healers across the globe. Because just as we, you know, are trying to light people up to their own healing power, it's important for us to provide strength to our healing practitioners and help everyone, quote, come out of the closet. And my chief scientist often says, we're helping consciousness and healing come out of the scientific closet, right? So, but this means that we can all really stand in our truth as these healing agents and open the conversations. And as you have that, you know, that conversation with somebody in the grocery store or at a dinner party, you know, you open the space for them to share their story. And then this becomes much more understandable and less of an anomaly. People start realizing this is just part of the human experience.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, coming out of the closet, there's so many people have had these experiences and are terrified, right, of mentioning them, because either, you know, a family member is going to think that they're crazy, or worse, they'll lose their jobs, you know. And so I think normalizing this to know, I mean, think about it, hasn't been that long really at all since we've even had the conversation that consciousness exists outside of the human brain. There's still scientists who still believe that consciousness doesn't exist after the body dies.
And that's fine. It's their right. They can believe that for the rest of their lives. From my vantage point, you can believe that, and you can think about energy healing and its mechanisms any way you want. But ultimately, if it works, it needs to be in the hospital. It's just that simple.
Yeah, and it needs to be integrated. So anyway, thank you so much for the work that you do to bridge and bring science and spirituality together. It's so important.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Renee. It's been an honor. It's been a really fun conversation. Thanks for having it with me.
Oh, same here. And we'll be putting up links on the screen so you can find out more information about her work, her organization, and her book. You've been listening to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. You can learn more about our work at bluesoulearth.com, studywithspirit.com, and bluesoulmedia.com.
Also, head over to bluesoulsummit.com, where you can watch video interviews, each season tackling a particular topic. We are also at Blue Soul Earth on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Clubhouse.
Join us for a future episode of Blue Soul Chats, where we hope to ignite your soul's journey, expand your awareness, and deepen your consciousness.
Thanks for being here, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and listen to previous episodes in our library.